the Battleground State Report with Steve Gill, Michael Patrick Leahy, and Doug Kellett.
And welcome in. This is the Battleground State Report. Go to battlegroundstatenews.com. That's battlegroundstatenews.com on the web to find links to some of the stories that we're talking about this weekend. And it has been a crazy week in Washington as the shutdown continues, as the battle over the border wall continues, as we see state after state dealing with some of the aftermath of the midterm elections in North Carolina. You've got some evidence that illegal aliens were voting. You've got other states that are starting to go back and see how some of the elections were won or lost with voter harvesting or ballot harvesting. So as we look to 2020, how the process works is clearly going to be impactful, and hopefully some of these states will tighten up the voter ID requirements. North Carolina is moving ahead on that, for example. But as we look to Washington, we also see an effort by the Democrats, who are now newly embedded in control of the House, pursuing a much different agenda than they pursued on the campaign trail. They didn't run on "we're going to take your guns." They didn't run on "we're going to abolish ICE and spend all our time trying to let more illegals come in and climb onto the backs of American taxpayers." They didn't spend all their time promising impeachment and investigation, but yet that's all we're getting out of Washington under the Democrats controlling the House.
Absolutely. And Steve, just a reminder, what the Battleground State Report is about, why we're different. We focus on the local news and the impact of national news on 17 key battleground states that will determine the outcome of the 2020 presidential election. There are 20 red states that are going to vote for Donald Trump no matter what. And there are 13 blue states that are going to vote against Donald Trump no matter what. The 17 battleground states, I'll just run through them quickly: Nevada, Arizona, Colorado, New Mexico in the west, Minnesota, Iowa, Missouri, Wisconsin, Michigan, Indiana, Ohio, and Pennsylvania in the Midwest. In New England, it's New Hampshire and Maine. In the South, Virginia, North Carolina, and Florida. So we talk about local stories there, the impact of these national issues on voter behavior in these battleground states, because when you look at national polls, they are irrelevant.
Well, and we've seen a little bit of that. There was a Quinnipiac poll that came out this week that indicates that in these battleground states, in the Midwest, for example, a significant majority of people believe there is a crisis in the border. When you look at the voters that are in those blue-collar, not necessarily college-educated positions in those particular states, overwhelming support for the idea that there is a crisis at the border. And we actually had a story up in battlegroundstatenews.com this week about the impact among Catholic voters in those particular states. As you look at the polling, don't get deceived by what the national polls say, because what people in, you know, New York or California who really hate Donald Trump think really doesn't matter as much as when you look at the policy impact in places like Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and these states. And our story in the Battleground State News this week focused on the fact that when you look at, well, just Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan, 46 electoral votes in those three states alone. Donald Trump carried those three states by a total of 107,000 votes. 107,000 votes going the other way. Pennsylvania, for example, I think it was an 11 or 20,000 vote margin. You swing those states the other way, it's a different result. In 2020, the Catholic vote in those states is likely going to dictate whether Donald Trump gets reelected or not. And right now, the Democrats seem to be declaring war on Catholics by attacking Knights of Columbus, by attacking people of faith who are Catholic or Christian evangelical. That is playing right into the hands of a Donald Trump reelection.
Doug Kellett, what do you have to say about that? Don't you think it's a really bad strategy in battleground states for the Democrats to be attacking great organizations, Catholic organizations like the Knights of Columbus?
I've always thought it was kind of an opportunity, really, for Republicans in some of these states. You know, people of faith have, you know, certain core values. And I always thought it was a mistake, really, for Republicans not to go after the Catholic vote in the Midwest. These were the old Reagan Democrats that I always thought, you know, it was an opportunity there. And I think President Trump did a good job, you know, during the election, actually going and speaking with them. I just wonder, guys, how long this government shutdown is, not only goes on, but when is it going to make a difference politically, right? I mean, is it favoring Trump, or will it favor the Democrats? In other words, at some point, how long does it go on before we can kind of determine who's really winning this thing?
Well, you're starting to see some poll numbers. There was one just out and I'll have to pull. I'm not sure exactly who did the poll, but it was,
I think, Quinnipiac, maybe?
Quinnipiac did one earlier this week, but there's another one that comes out and shows that Trump's made about a 20-point gain among Latino and Hispanic voters in just the last month during the border wall dispute. You've got a lot of Latino and Hispanic voters who have followed the rules, who have played fairly, and I don't think they like the imagery of thousands of these poor, uneducated, dispossessed people coming from Central America, South America, crossing the border illegally. You know, if you're an honest, decent, hardworking Latino American who has played by the rules, the imagery that is being placed in the American mindset of who you are based upon what they're seeing in this border dispute, I think does have people saying, oh, let's shut it down and let's play by the rules.
You know,
how big a number, you know, Michael and I have been talking about it on the daily program, but how big an issue are these federal employees, 800,000? Do they, you know, some of these states make a difference? You talked about how close some of these votes were. Could they make a difference if they're not happy with the way things are going here?
Well, certainly in Northern Virginia and in Maryland, but two states that Republicans are unlikely to win in the presidential race simply because of that large bureaucratic Democrat population that's surrounding Washington, D.C. So, yeah, you know, it's going to have an impact in Maryland. It's going to have an impact in Washington, D.C. Tennessee, for example, I think you've got 25,000 federal employees. Not everybody who's a federal employee is even laid off. Most of these departments have been funded. So it's a limited number, and it's kind of spread across the country. So while, again, like a Pennsylvania, a Michigan, a Wisconsin, there may be enough votes to swing. But as President Trump has pointed out, they're already Democrat votes. He's not going to get them, so he doesn't really have anything to lose in those cases. We'll talk more about it and break down the impact on Jewish voters when you have Muslim members of Congress who are anti-Semitic and trashing Israel. How does it play again? Is that 10, 20, 40,000 votes in some of these key states as well as the Democrats go all in anti-Israel, anti-Semitic? How does that play? We'll talk more about it in a moment.
Dawn is breaking, it's early morn. The taxi's waiting, he's blown his horn. Already I'm so lonesome I could die. So kiss me and smile for me. Tell me that you'll wait for me. Hold me like you'll never let me go.
Sorry, Nancy Pelosi, you're not actually going to be leaving on that jet plane. Yeah, that may have been the song kind of bouncing through Nancy Pelosi's head as she was getting ready to board the plane and head out on a international trip on military aircraft until Donald Trump dropped the bomb on her that, no, Nancy, you're not going anywhere. I'm not going to let you fly on military jets and shut her down. Now, the other song that came to my mind in addition to that one was that old song, The Wheels on the Bus Go Round and Round, the old nursery rhyme song, because Democrats were literally on the bus headed to the airport when Trump pulled their plane trip, and they had to literally circle the Capitol and do that walk of shame back into the Capitol with their luggage. It was an epic moment. It was a mic drop moment. And I talked to one of my friends who works in the Trump White House and said, man, whoever came up with that idea deserves an extra piece of pie at dinner tonight. And they said, oh, no. That was pure Trump. He came up with that one on his own. And, man, it has the memes, the just humor. And then, again, the Democrats are making themselves mockworthy. And Doug, we've talked about this for years. You can overcome a lot in politics. You can even overcome scandal and sexting and all these sorts of things. You can overcome almost anything. But when you become a joke, when you become a laughingstock, it's hard to get past that. And Nancy Pelosi, between the Chuck Schumer, Nancy Pelosi optics of responding to the president's border presentation with their bizarre appearance, and then you combine it with this, they're becoming a joke, and it's their fault.
Yeah, I had one thought about it. It's like Nancy Pelosi wants to leave the country. why did we stop her, right?
And then, yeah, some people have said the president shouldn't have grounded the flight on the way out. He should have grounded it on the way back in.
Right. Then it would have been perfect, in my opinion there. I'm sorry the government shut down, and until the government reopens, you're stuck in Afghanistan. So that's it. I mean, there's so much you say about it. I mean, as far as the trip and whatever value, if it has any value at all, it'll be delayed and they can do it at a later time. It just, I think, shows maybe the animosity between the president and Nancy Pelosi, perhaps.
You
right?
think? Yeah. And apparently, I don't know that this was even a bipartisan, you know, they call it congressional delegation, a CODEL. It doesn't appear that this was even a bipartisan trip. Apparently, Republicans weren't invited on this kind of worldwide tour. I don't know if they were having like a rock band where they had T-shirts and silk jackets with the schedule on the back of the jacket. But apparently, this was a Democrats-only trip.
Yeah, I mean, what were they going to gather, right? I mean, they're going to, what, Brussels, Egypt, Afghanistan, and, you know, I mean, I don't know what value there would be, especially at this point. Michael and I were talking about it on another program that at least they didn't go to Puerto Rico again. Perhaps that was, you know, one of the advantages there.
So, Doug, back to your earlier point, you know, you'd asked the question, who does the shutdown hurt in battleground states, and how do the 800,000 furloughed government employees, federal government employees, react? And I think the point is, you know, Virginia is one of our 17 battleground states. Hillary Clinton won it by 5 points. It has been moving to purple. It was red. It moved to purple. It's been purple. Now it's moving towards blue. To your point, I think that may be the one state influenced negatively for President Trump in 2020 by the shutdown. And evidence of that is the first critic publicly to criticize President Trump for basically denying access to the military plane to Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats was Virginia Senator Mark Warner, who floated this idea that somehow the president had violated the law because in his letter he mentioned that she was going to Afghanistan. Now, that's kind of ludicrous, but I think it is.
Well, except he mentioned she was going to Afghanistan after she wasn't going to Afghanistan.
Yeah, so how could that violate the law?
It's not like it was a security impact, because I'm sorry, she's not going to be in Afghanistan, so that doesn't, you know, create any threat to her.
But I do think,
I guess I was thinking, guys, that it, you know, Virginia was not really one, I guess, you know, that I was counting on to, you know, in the next election. I'm thinking more of the Midwestern, you know, states, the ones that Trump won, like Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, that you talked about, that, you know, he really has to win again, right? I mean, and where the small margin of victory and the number of federal employees might make a difference.
Well,
that's what I was thinking.
There's not nearly as many in those other battleground states in the Midwest as there are in Northern Virginia. I think the more interesting related phenomena, though, for how these Midwest battleground states like Michigan and Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and Minnesota, how they play out is the increasing polarization within geographic areas of those states. The cities are getting bluer and bluer and more left-wing and more. In the case of Minnesota, where the Muslim representative woman Ilhan Omar, who purportedly may have engaged in immigration fraud to get to marry her brother or something like that.
And has just been appointed by Pelosi as a member of the Foreign Affairs Committee of the U.S. House.
She's been appointed. She was born in Somalia. She came here as a refugee. She's constantly pictured wearing her hijab. She has repeatedly sent out tweets and statements that are anti-Semitic, anti-Israel, has vigorously defended her attacks on Israel. How does that play out in a state, in a battleground state like Minnesota, where Donald Trump only lost by 40,000 votes?
Well, and when you look at the rest of Minnesota outside Minneapolis, like most of these states, is very red. Same thing in Michigan. You've got Rashid Tlaib, who is this Palestinian Muslim member of Congress, who, again, dropped the F-bomb on Trump, has danced around with a Palestinian flag, not an American flag, when she got elected, and, again, is repeating these same sort of anti-Israel, anti-Semitic statements. I think that this is going to create a backlash against, and unfairly in many cases, good, honest, America-loving Muslims who do not subscribe to the radical views, but these are the voices that are going to be heard. These are the images that are going to be heard. And I think that this creates even more backlash against the Democrats. And frankly, again, the more that Americans see Alexandria Cortez, the more that they see the Ilhan Omars and the Rashid Tlaibs and the Maxine Waters and the rest of the cast of crazies, I think that that overcomes what your point is, Doug, is that you have some federal employees who may be upset over being, you know, unpaid for a period of time. But by the time we get to the election, this is going to be old news. They're going to have gotten paid when they didn't work. There's going to be some inconvenience in the short term. But I think the president's calculation has been, these are all career bureaucrats. These are all embedded Democrats. The American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees, their union, is affirmatively anti-Republican, anti-Trump. Those aren't votes he's going to get anyway. So if he's winning the votes of those blue-collar Ohio, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin workers who are seeing their jobs taken by the illegal aliens and want to stop that, I think he wins more than he loses.
Yeah, I understand the number of people, you know, the Virginia, you know, Maryland area, the people who work for the federal government are predominantly Democrats. I get that. I'm just thinking out in the rest of the country here that, you know, many of these federal employees may have voted for Donald Trump, right? They may be Republicans. They're not necessarily Democrats. We don't know that for sure, do we?
I don't know, man. You go to the state capitals and look at the bureaucratic workers, whether you're in Georgia, whether you're in Mississippi. Those bureaucratic state employees and federal employees are overwhelmingly Democrat. And again, you look at their labor unions and who they back and who they support with money and PAC contributions. It's going to be Democrats, members of Congress, Democrat senators, and Democrat presidential candidates. I mean, you look at the Democratic Convention. I mean, not only do they have a bunch of teachers union employees that are at the Democratic Convention, you've also got these state, federal, and local bureaucratic employees. So, again, there may be a small percentage, but I don't know that it's, again, in a state like a Michigan, maybe there's 45,000 total federal employees. You know, Trump may lose 5,000 of them.
Yeah, and I think, Doug, if you say, how's the shutdown playing out in battleground states? It's making Virginia more likely to vote against Trump in 2020, and it's making virtually all the other 16 more likely to vote for Donald Trump in 2020. That's my view.
Particularly, again, when you look at the drug issue. I mean, a statistic this week that to me was shocking. Americans are more likely to die from an opioid overdose than they are to die in a car crash now. We have more people dying of opioid overdose than dying in car wrecks in America now. I think that continued flood of drugs, the impact that it's having on our cities, our towns, our families, our loved ones, those kind of things I think are going to impact. And I think, again, if the president and his team can communicate more effectively what the border fight is really about, it is about security. It is about job growth and job creation and job retention. Maybe they'll be able to balance out against some angry federal employees who didn't get paid for a few weeks. We'll talk more about it. This is the Battleground State Report. Go to battlegroundstatenews.com on the web. Steve Gill, Michael Leahy, and Doug Kellett, all with you breaking down the information, and we'll be right back in a couple of moments.
The Battleground State Report with Steve Gill, Michael Patrick Leahy, and Doug Kellett.
You know, everybody thinks, 2020, man, that's a long way away. But as you get Democrats announcing for president, well, we've had Beto, don't I have nice white teeth, and would you like to see them cleaned, O'Rourke. You have Elizabeth Warren's already announced. You have Kirsten Gillibrand, who's announced. I mean, the cast of characters who are already jumping into the presidential race on the Democratic side of the aisle, we may have, 30, 40 candidates before the end of this year, heading towards the New Hampshire primary, the Iowa caucuses. You know, Doug, we've been up to New Hampshire a couple of times for the primary. It is the Super Bowl of politics, and everybody that's jumping in will presumably still be in for that round. Literally, you're going to have 20, 30 candidates on the ballot in addition to kind of the crazy guys. But who's the guy that wears the boot on his head up in New Hampshire and runs every time for president? I mean, you've got a cast of crazies in addition to the cast of crazies that the Democrats are going to put up as their, quote, legitimate candidates. And it's already begun.
Yeah, I mean, think about it. There may be, what, 20 or so already that are they're sure thing of getting in. It's going to be like the Republicans where they had 17 and we had to have, what, two different debates, right? We had sort of the tier one and tier two group that's on there. I mean, it
yeah, kind of like the Emmys. They'd have the after party.
Run. Yeah,
the party and the after party.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, what is it? President Trump kept saying, "Yeah, you know, I started out at the end of the row because they kind of ranked them from the middle of the stage to the center based upon the poll." Trump moved from literally being almost off stage to the center and kept moving people down the row as the polls came out. So
and they didn't want to be next to him because he would attack them and they'd move line towards the end.
Yeah, maybe if I'm out of his line of sight, he'll forget about me.
Well, we do have two key battleground states where the Democrats have already begun campaigning. In Iowa, Elizabeth Pocahontas Warren the other week was there. She went to Storm Lake, Iowa, which her advanced people missed this very important element. It, to the west of it, it's like Cherokee County, and to the east of it is Pocahontas County.
Yeah, not good advance work by her advance team and say, yeah, let's go there and just kind of bring this up. And then this just bizarre, you know, I'm going to, you know, have this live streaming of me getting my teeth cleaned or
that was
I'm going to get me a beer.
No, I mean, so you've got Elizabeth Warren who says, you know she's lying when she says, right, which she says often. So she says, I think I'm going to get me a beer. How often does she ever said that before she did this Instagram thing?
Well, and then even the new Congressman Crenshaw, who achieved some level of fame when Saturday Night Live, you know, took him on, is pointing out that
the
Beto,
veteran who lost an eye in Iraq.
Yeah, Purple Heart winner and doing a great job, by the way, already in Congress. He's pointed out that Beto's teeth cleaning was not cool. It was just weird. And I think, again, as the American people look at some of these people, they're going to be going, really, I don't get what they're trying to do.
Well, someone I know coined a great phrase to describe what's happening in American politics. That would be Steve Gill sitting across from us here in the studio. And that is the Kardashianization of American culture and politics.
Well, I mean, these people are all driven by how many likes, how many clicks can I get, which is great if you're trying to, you know, sell bathroom tissue or something. But you've got Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who is so desiring to be seen, to be getting her 15 minutes of fame, which is now extended apparently into 30 minutes or so. She's now doing a seminar for other new members of Congress on how to get clicks, how to use tweet and Facebook. So it is the Kardashianization and Ocasio-Cortezization of the political scheme. I think, though, that you're seeing Democrats in Washington already start to say, look, we got to figure a way to rein this in. Ocasio-Cortez only won her primary election, with 15,000 votes or so. There were only 25,000 total votes cast. She won like 15,000 to 11,000. She's, I think, at serious risk of a primary opponent, despite her fame around the country. What are people in the district going to feel like that she's actually doing for them? And the same thing is going to be true with Ilhan Omar in Minneapolis and with Rashid Tlaib. They didn't win by overwhelming margins, and they're setting themselves up, I think, for tough primary challenge, particularly Ocasio-Cortez, when she's already spewing this, we're going to run candidates against our fellow Democrats in primaries. Yeah, that edge, that sword cuts both ways.
So, Doug.
Yeah, but I'm thinking of Cortez, though. I mean, you know, she's like 4 million followers, I think, on YouTube or something like that. And she certainly could give a lesson to Beto, right? I mean, do you think how many likes do you think Beto got with his teeth cleaning thing? I mean, it's
I'm betting Ocasio-Cortez for the Super Bowl of likes decides to do, you know, okay, he's going to get his teeth cleaned. I'm going in for a breast exam. I mean, that'll launch likes like nobody's ever seen before.
Well, there you go. I mean, there's always a way to make it happen, I guess. But I'm with you. The most bizarre, I think, of all is not, you know, Alexandria dancing and doing her dance or whatever on YouTube. It's why would you go to a dentist's office and continue your series on whatever it was he was talking about while you're getting your teeth cleaned? Nobody likes to go to the dentist anyway.
Yeah, that's a really great question. And to follow up, it is a great example. This tells you how great their field is. Apparently, everyone is trying to be to follow the example of the 29-year-old Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Francis Beto O'Rourke, former congressman who lost the Texas Senate race by 3%, raised $80 million, lost by 3 points to Ted Cruz. Clearly, and he's not yet announced or formed an exploratory committee yet, clearly he thinks that the Kardashianization of America is what's going to win this presidential nomination for him. And therefore, he thought, oh, yeah, let's do a live Instagram video feed of, me getting my teeth cleaned. Doug, how does that play out to voters in Iowa, and where they have the first Democratic caucus in February of 2020? How does it play out to voters in New Hampshire, where they have the first Democratic presidential primary in February 2020?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's you're trying to advocate that Iowans have great teeth, right? I mean, that therefore this is going to play to it. I don't know. I can't imagine who would come up with the idea that this would actually be some sort of advantage. Yeah, I guess it stands out because we're talking about it. But how does it really get your votes in the long run, right? I think as you and Steve are talking about it, it's the less serious sort of aspect of politics these days, right? I mean, a lot of these Democrats have been announcing on these late night comedian shows.
Yeah, you got Kamala Harris, you've got Amy Klobuchar, and Tulsi Gabbard. I mean, I think there's about six or seven Democrat women who are now running. So this identity politics is driving the field. I'm sorry for Beto O'Rourke, or as some people are now calling him, Dinto O'Rourke. sorry, dude, you're a white male. You know, so unless he's going to go transgender, I'm not sure how he's going to, you know, cut himself away from the rest of the pack. And again, if you've got 20 or 30 candidates that are kind of starting out of the blocks, now again, a bunch of them are going to find it's easier to talk about it. You can go to Iowa and New Hampshire right now and draw some attention. Raising the money to actually run a national campaign is a lot more difficult than these folks are going to figure out that it is. But you still have a lot of names that are dividing up, balkanizing the potential vote. And where's everybody's second, third, or fourth choice if their top choice moves away?
Say, and also, Doug, let me ask you this. What medical procedure will Beto O'Rourke next do a live Facebook feed on?
You know, you really want me to say it, right?
I mean,
if you want to ask, what's the most appropriate procedure that he could show on YouTube? And I think we can all get yes. What would probably be appropriate there.
we'll leave that one hanging. We could say the word. Our audience knows which procedure would be appropriate. For
Turn your head and cough there, Beto.
Too much fun.
Of course, again,
it makes me
hurt,
actually.
Where's the sound effect of, when you have the Beto, you know, dental cleaning, you know, use the drill. I mean, if you really want to remind people how much they hate dentists, you want that, not just the teeth cleaning piece.
I just have to turn it off. I mean, it's like, okay, he's got great teeth, but what else do you got, right?
They are very white.
This week, though, the over-under on the betting on Beto O'Rourke, actually, I think it's gone down, at least among pundits, because that little dental exercise, the teeth cleaning exercise, showed really the high quality of his preparation. You know, he went down to the border, right? And everybody that went with him said, he's an idiot. He doesn't know anything about the border. And so I think his lack of substance is very apparent. So my guess is not playing so well in Iowa and New Hampshire.
Well, again, some of these candidates are, you know, talking, and some of the members of Congress talking about President Trump and whether he's going to, you know, be able to win the border fight. And then they're talking about other members of the Senate and their district. I'm sorry, a senator doesn't have a district. They have a state. So, I mean, the lack of capacity to even understand basic civics that we're seeing on display by some of these Democrats, including those running for president, is frightening. These are people who are in power. We'll talk more about it as the Battleground State Report continues. Go to battlegroundstatenews.com. You'll find links to some of the stories we're talking about today, and we'll be right back.
Battleground State Report with Steve Gill, Michael Patrick Leahy, and Doug Kellen.
Hey, welcome back in. This is the Battleground State Report. As always, go to battlegroundstatenews.com where you'll find some of the stories that we're covering from across the 17 or so battleground states that will impact not just control of the Senate, control of the House, and control of the White House after the 2020 elections. You know, we haven't talked much about the impact on state House and state Senate races also, because when you have, for example, California that is just beyond the reach for Republicans to really compete for in the presidential race, the lack of presidential candidate attention there, the lack of grassroots organization there, does have an impact on state House and state Senate races. When you look the same way in red states, the Democrats don't really play there. And therefore, for example, in Tennessee, you've now got super majorities of Republicans controlling the state House and the state Senate. This kind of separate America into only 17 states mattering has an impact on those state House and state Senate races. And a lot of candidates who might be very good representation of their districts, their communities, aren't really getting an opportunity because everything's so divided politically that some states don't even get the competitive battles locally that produces the best results. I mean, competition produces good results. When you have to compete, it makes you put up your best candidates. It makes you put up your best policies, be clear. That's where you build up the farm team for later members of Congress and Senate and presidents. And I think this division of red and blue being so deeply divided is hurting the farm team approach to getting good people even entering politics. Because if you're in a dark blue or dark red district, but you're a Republican or a Democrat kind of in the minority, there's no even shot to get into the game.
Exactly right. And you see that with that polarization, particularly on the left, what you see is the people that rise are from far left districts of blue states. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Maxine Waters, and they become the poster child for this, you know, crazy left-wing set of policies, and it further divides the country. Now, interesting enough, you see, now let's take a battleground state like Pennsylvania. The little things that happen that can have some impact on 2020 that You see these things going on, you wonder, well, is that going to be significant or not? Let me give you an example. Just this week, a Republican who was reelected to the House of Representatives in 2018 to a fifth term, Tom Marino, he announced his resignation. Now, there's going to be a special election.
He's only been sworn in like 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, so it's like either there were some critical stories in the press before his reelection about being too close to pharmaceuticals. Maybe he's going to get a job as a lobbyist for pharmaceuticals. I don't know. You always wonder, well, what's going on? Is there some scandal there? You don't know. But the impact of that resignation is going to politicize Pennsylvania early on, and it's going to be one of those battleground states. So you're going to see the special election now become a warm-up, shall we say, for the 2020 election, as if we need another election.
Yeah, and again, all politics is local, as Tip O'Neill used to always say. And I think, again, that's where this divide, this polarization is taking away the local impact. You know, we've been talking a little bit, Doug, about how does the battle over the wall, the shutdown affect the battleground states looking to 2020. I think, you know, just kind of another step further than that, when the Democrats seem to be so focused on every issue other than how are our policies actually helping somebody in my district. You know, when they're talking about impeaching Trump or investigating Trump or some of the other issues that seem to captivate so much of the attention in Washington, D.C., do the folks that are in Sioux City, Iowa, going to the drugstore today trying to figure out how to pay for their medication or trying to get to Kroger and get their kids to soccer practice, is anything in Washington affecting the daily lives of those people? And as these politicians move themselves further from what affects real, hardworking, law-abiding, decent Americans, as they fight over making sure illegals have access to our country, get on the taxpayer back, I think that's what has the impact in terms of voters heading into 2020 a lot more than who can, you know, show their dental procedure.
Yeah, I mean, think about it. Back in the 90s, right? I mean, there was a big move about the way districts were being created and written, and so the districts were drawn where you had it almost assured some Democrat would win a district like a Maxine Waters or something like that. But on the other hand, it also assured more Republicans to get elected. And I'm just wondering, if kind of following along what you were saying, if maybe because the districts are not in more of a broad sense of demographics, you know, in various neighborhood patterns and all of this, is why you've got more to the left and more to the right. You need not appeal in any way to sort of the masses, right? I mean, you don't have to appeal to a different sort of demographic to actually win the election, because they're not there.
Well, and that's certainly what we're seeing with the Ocasio-Cortezes and the Bernie Sanders. The extreme left is dominating the Democratic Party and making that party move further to the left, as these Democrats are concerned about primaries. That may play well in California and New York. But the question is, how does that play in Ohio, Michigan, Pennsylvania? They move further and further away from those mainstream values that that Trump appealed to. I think it hurts them in 2020. I hope they'll keep doing what they're doing. And we saw that a little bit with the Republicans when the Tea Party drove a lot of Republicans to move so far to the right that they lost that capacity to win those moderate, middle, mainstream voters on the issues that actually affect their lives. I think the Republicans made a mistake in that way, and they've kind of swum back. The populist candidacy of Donald Trump appealed to people's pocketbooks, appealed to people's values, appealed to people's concerns about national security and border security and their own community security, the future for their kids. You're not hearing Democrats talk about that. Now they're wanting to push a $15 an hour minimum wage that Bernie Sanders and the socialists think is the answer. I mean, heck, make it $100 an hour and then everybody will be rich if you believe that that's the answer. $15 an hour minimum wage, we've already seen it in states and communities where they've imposed it, drives people out of work, and you're going to see more kiosks at fast food restaurants. You're going to see less opportunity. And there's one estimate that 2 to 3 million Americans will lose their jobs as a result of some $15 an hour minimum wage, because a kiosk is a lot less expensive than $15 an hour. And you don't have to worry about whether it shows up on time for work.
And the other part of that, Steve, which we talked about before, is if they do that, it will eliminate the opportunity for many teenagers to get that first job. And as you know, I mean, teenagers, you know, you get a first job, you start to learn what it is to show up on time, to follow the rules, you know, to perform your duties as prescribed. Already we have a problem with kids getting that first job and getting that experience and being able to do it. It's just going to make it even worse if they have this $15 minimum wage, $15 an hour minimum wage that the left wing Bernie Sanders is proposing.
It was interesting that the Democrats went down to Puerto Rico instead of down to Venezuela. I mean, if Venezuela is so hot, you know, and awesome from an economic standpoint, why didn't the Democrats go down to Venezuela and their beaches instead of Puerto Rico?
Exactly. Doug, you were going to add something.
No, I was
there.
Just going to say the market should decide on what the payment you should be. I mean, I have no problem if there's some kind of minimum out there, but in some places, you know, the $15 an hour might make sense, but in other places, it would put somebody out of business, right? I mean, if you go to the kiosk like Steve is talking about, at least we get our orders correct now, but that's about it. Really, you're not helping anything, and people still like to talk to somebody, you know, when they go up to the counter.
Well, and the bottom line is that employers are actually, thanks to the Trump economy, tax cuts, regulatory cuts, they're finding it hard to attract workers. So what's going to drive wages up is the fact that I've got to pay you a little bit more or give you a little bit better benefits or provide you a better job than somebody down the street can offer. That competitiveness is what raises the wages, not just at that starting level, but over a career. And we're seeing that play out. I talked to a friend of mine in Washington yesterday who used to work at the Department of Labor. One of the unseen benefits of the Trump recovery, the Trump economy, the Democrats are doing everything they can to stop, was it just among veterans in this country, the number of veterans that have now been employed, that have been moved off the unemployment rolls, we have the lowest unemployment rate among U.S. military veterans that we've ever seen. And as a result, we've also seen less people having to collect unemployment benefits. We've dropped the unemployment benefits, and this is usually from a state level, being paid to veterans from $1 billion a year to $200 million a year. That's an $800 million savings to taxpayers, and you have vets that are now paying taxes instead of collecting money from taxpayers. Those stories aren't getting told, and I blame that. The Trump administration ought to be trumpeting that and other issues, you know, a lot louder than they are.
Well, the big issue is the shutdown, and, you know, who's to blame for it? So it's time for prediction time here. Next week at the Battleground State Report, will we still be in a partial federal shutdown? Steve Gill, what say you?
Yes.
Doug Kellett, what say you?
I say no doubt about it. We'll still be in a shutdown because they're not even talking.
I say we're 3 for 3. There will still be a partial federal government shutdown. And the question now to follow up on that, does this help or hurt Donald Trump in 2020 in the battleground states? What do you think, Steve?
I think it's moving in Trump's direction. I think the highlighting that this is border security, this is national security, the fact that you've got another caravan heading through Mexico with Mexico not doing anything to stop it, thousands of people more pouring towards our border. And when you look at these caravans, when you start seeing the images again, it's going to be military age males. It is not people that are going to evoke the kind of sympathy that the Democrats are trying to create. And I think the visuals, the optics, are in Donald Trump's favor. And as this battle continues, at some point the Democrats will start to see a crack in their wall as their constituents are going to say, why are we letting more people in to take my tax dollars, to take my job, and to put my kids at risk?
What say you, Doug?
Well, I guess I'm going to be the oddball. I think the president wins on the wall, but I think there are two issues, not, and I know they're connected at this point, but I think he wins on the wall, but I think the longer the shutdown goes on, I think eventually he gets blamed for it. I think, he said he would take credit for it, and I think people expect the deal maker, the art of the deal, to make a deal, and so far we don't see it.
What about this?
But I will say, Doug, as he said, it's easier to deal with Kim Jong-un, a dictator in North Korea, than to deal with Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, who have said, we're not even going to negotiate. We're not going to move on an issue that they have voted to fund the wall in the past. Again, I think the Trump team needs to make them put up or shut up and say, well, then, do you think we should tear down the existing wall since you find it immoral and you have funded that wall in the past? Are you now saying we need to tear down this wall?
I just think eventually, I think it's just a mixed bag right now that we really don't know that generally the administration in power would be blamed for the government not operating. And so I just think if it goes on indefinitely, like a lot of people think that it will, that eventually it may hurt him more. But I think he wins on the wall issue. I think most people agree with him on that.
But except for the federal employees, when you talk about, who's being inconvenienced by this, the polls overwhelmingly show that most Americans are saying, hadn't affected me at all. The government shutdown isn't affecting most people's daily lives. And despite the claims in the national media that it's, causing people to starve to death, they've only missed one paycheck for about 3 or 4 days at this point.
Last question. Where will President Trump deliver his State of the Union address?
He's coming over to my house. We're going to telecast it.
I like that. What do you say, Doug?
I think the idea of the Senate was a good one, but I think he does it from the Oval Office.
All right. I think he does it from a location outside of Washington, D.C., in a battleground state at a big venue.
That'd be my advice. I mean, go to a big, he holds these 40,000, 50,000 people rallies or something, or usually they're 10 or 15 to 20,000. If you did the State of the Union in a 25,000-seat coliseum somewhere, invite Congress to come if they want to, that would be epic. It would be historic, and Trump likes doing both of those things.
It needs to be in a warm weather climate, though, right?
He can come to your house then.
We've got room.
We'll be back next week with more of the Battleground State Report. Go to battlegroundstatenews.com in the meantime. That's battlegroundstatenews.com or Battleground State News on Facebook. And you have a great week. We'll be back again next week.